Every human being enters the world through a mother, making birth the first door we all pass through. It's universal, primal, and foundational to existence. Inextricably attached to that first door, though, is another door, motherhood. You walk through this door, and when you step back out, nothing fits the same. Not your body, not your mind, not your place in the world. It's like getting tossed out of the life you knew and waking up somewhere else. Still you, but stretched, cracked open, inside out. Some walk through it in a hospital room, sweat-soaked and screaming. Some walk through it in a courtroom, signing papers with trembling hands. Some become mothers in an instant. Others, after years of waiting. Some through grief, through sacrifice, through marriage. However it happens, it often is different than the story we thought we'd be living. But here's the thing no one tells you about being a mom. Motherhood doesn't just happen once. You keep walking through that door with every late night wake up, every scraped knee, every whispered prayer, every moment you realize you are no longer just someone's daughter. You are someone's mother, someone's safe place, someone's first home. To talk about motherhood is to talk about history, about power, about pain and endurance, and how the world only keeps spinning because mothers let their bodies, their hearts, their very lives be split open so it can. Despite shaping the world, motherhood remains one of history's most under-documented forces. It's both deeply personal and universally shared, yet because it happens in nurseries, in kitchens, and in bedrooms, rather than on battlefields or in parliaments, it's often erased from the grand narrative of history. This is the story of that first door, of what it means to walk through it and emerge a mother, and how it profoundly shapes the world we live in. Motherhood is history's greatest untold story. It's built empires, fueled revolutions, and pushed the boundaries of science. And yet, because it happens in quiet rooms, behind closed doors, it's been left out of the grand narrative. But make no mistake, motherhood is not just tenderness. It's raw, unrelenting, a force that tears you apart and remakes you over and over again. It's blood, bone, love, and sheer will. This isn't a story about sacrifice. It's a story about power, about what it means to become a mother and what it means to never stop becoming. This is Bloodline and Backbone. One day I'm going home. I feel it deep inside of my soul. I ain't got a lot of silver and gold. I got what cannot be sold. I'm gonna see it in. So take what you wanna take, but you can't take it to the grave. You know everything is fading away. I might not have it today, but I'ma see it in. I had a friend tell me about a recent visit to Lodge Grass, Montana, visiting some leaders of the Crow Nation for the youth nonprofit she works for. She met a man named Eddie, who knew every detail of his family's history for 400 years. Every name, every place they lived, every birth, every death. It's been orally passed down through the generations. In fact, this is common among members of many First Nation tribes. Think about that for a second. Most of us know the names of our four grandparents. Some of us might even know the name of a few great-grandparents, though probably not all eight of them. Our great-grandparents represent our family history three generations back. But knowing your history for 400 years, that's 15 generations. Anyone who's ever done ancestral DNA testing knows there's something sacred about knowing the intricate details of your history, the roots that spread far and wide and somewhere along the way converge at you, making you, you. What is it about knowing where you came from? See, the more we understand our history from our place of origin to long-lost siblings to our genetic predisposition toward the taste of cilantro, the more we understand ourselves. And when you understand yourself better, you walk through the world more confidently. Your feet plant themselves more firmly on the ground beneath you. Here's what one friend says about it. This is a conversation between her and her 92-year-old grandma.
I think Brittany wanted me to talk about what I would tell myself when I was younger. And that would take me back a lot of years. Did I say how old I was? I already did. I'm old enough to have forgotten already. Anyway, I have a granddaughter and a daughter laughing at me right now. It's kind of hard to keep a straight face. But to my younger self, and thinking about my younger self, I think I'm very, very glad that at my younger self time, I did not realize that I would live to be this age. But I would have to say that I've had a blessed life. It's been a good 92 years, I will have to say.
There's a cleaning supply brand called Seventh Generation that I buy regularly. The name comes from a law in the Iroquois Nation that says when elders decide for the tribe, they have to consider the impact of that decision on the seventh generation to follow. They understand their legacy is built by the decisions they make today. And knowing our family history affects how we show up in the world for better or for worse. Take Alexander, Lewis, and Brian. Family of origin? Hitler. The last three living descendants of Adolf Hitler, who have apparently decided that their bloodline will die with them. They've all chosen to not have kids.
Growing up in post-war America, these brothers faced unique challenges. The shadow of their great uncle Adolf Hitler loomed large, creating a psychological burden that shaped their lives. As adults, they made conscious choices to blend into American society, pursuing careers that allowed them to maintain anonymity. The Stuart Houston brothers have largely avoided media attention, granting only rare interviews. When they have spoken publicly, they've emphasized their commitment to living normal lives and distancing themselves from their great uncle's legacy. However, their most significant decision goes beyond career choices or avoiding the public eye. It was a deliberate act, one that ensured their famous bloodline would never continue, sealing the fate of their family name forever. The brothers made a pact among themselves. They would not have children. This choice effectively brings an end to Adolf Hitler's bloodline, carrying immense symbolic weight. Was this their way of rejecting guilt or just a personal choice? Did they see it as a way to escape their past? Or was it their way of quietly accepting the weight of their family name? Either way, their decision shows just how impossible it was to fully escape their history. The Stuart Houston brothers proved that history's weight doesn't just disappear, it lingers. Their choice was the ultimate rejection of Hitler's obsession with legacy. In the end, his bloodline ended, not by force, but by choice.
And another thing about history? We can't choose it, and we can't change it. It's set in stone. All we can do is decide how to build our lives upon it moving forward. As the hit country song from the early 2000s suggests, your history makes you who you are. Family history aside, human history also informs our current reality in unseen ways. It shapes our media, culture, and beliefs. There are libraries upon libraries of historical accounts of great men and great women. Okay, mostly great men. Emperors through the ages, wars fought, lands conquered, the rooms where it happens.
No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened.
All of this makes up our collective human history. But there's something missing from the historical and cultural zeitgeist. Something that precedes, sustains, and weaves together the very fabric of our existence. Something that, left unexamined, could seem irrelevant to the day-to-day tasks that fill our years. The history of motherhood. Motherhood is the oldest story in the world. It shaped history, medicine, and culture, and yet, for something so monumental, it's barely told at all. There are no hit songs about childbirth, no Oscar-winning films about microchimerism, which is the miraculous and somewhat creepy phenomenon where a child's DNA can be found in a mother's bloodstream and brain for decades. Why is no one talking about this? There are no Tony-nominated plays about the way your daughter's laughter evolves over the decades. We sing about love, war, heartbreak, but not the moment two new lives tear their way into the world. One, emerging as an infant, and one, emerging as a mother. Maybe that's because motherhood demands surrender. It's raw, unpredictable, unrelenting, and the world doesn't quite know what to do with that. Somehow we've come to believe that the often unseen, unglamorous work of motherhood is ordinary. SNL creates skits about how uncool moms are. Somehow the infinite soul-splitting transformation of being a mother is seen as mundane, or at best, prosaic and sentimental. But they've gotten the narrative all wrong. And if motherhood isn't a story worth telling, then neither is history itself, because every war, every revolution, every moment that's ever mattered began with someone being born. And behind every one of them was a mother, bleeding, breaking, and becoming something new. Motherhood is not just a personal journey. It is a historical force, one that deserves to be remembered, studied, and most of all, told.
Okay.
Now, I know what you're thinking. This sounds dramatic, but trust me, if you've ever tried to wrangle a sleep-deprived toddler into a car seat while they scream like a medieval prisoner, you already know motherhood is a life-altering threshold experience. So first, let's run through a quick oral history of childbirth and parenting norms through the millennia.
Change is what's happening.
Oh, my dad,
me too.
Let's start all over again.
In early human societies, childbirth was both a spiritual and physical ordeal. Ancient Egyptians labored on birthing bricks, invoking the goddess Hathor for protection, while Mesopotamian midwives acted as both healers and religious figures, guiding women through birth with prayers and herbal medicine. But survival was never guaranteed. High infant mortality forced mothers to bear multiple children, often grieving more losses than celebrations. Emotional detachment was sometimes a necessity, yet in many cultures, the burden of child-rearing was shared. Children were raised not just by mothers, but by the entire village, blurring the modern notion of parental ownership. By the Middle Ages, childbirth had become an increasingly dangerous ordeal. Without sterilization or an understanding of germ theory, postpartum infections called childbed fever claimed the lives of countless mothers. Superstition thrived in the void of medical knowledge. Difficult births were sometimes even attributed to a woman's sins or supernatural forces. And at the same time, the idea of proper parenting was introduced, suggesting that child rearing should be outsourced to experts like wet nurses, nannies, and boarding schools. Children were seen as miniature adults, expected to contribute to labor and survival from an early age. It's now the 1800s. The 19th century brought hospitals, sanitation, and pain relief, but also new pressures on mothers. Queen Victoria famously demanded chloroform during childbirth, making pain relief more socially acceptable. The rise of germ theory drastically reduced maternal mortality, but the medicalization and homogenization of birth also stripped women of control over their own deliveries. Parenting took on new dimensions. With industrialization came the idea of childhood as a protected and precious phase of life, something almost unheard of in previous centuries. The nuclear family model began to solidify, and mothers were increasingly expected to focus entirely on child-rearing, while fathers worked outside the home. By the early 1900s, the shift from home to hospital births became even more prevalent, driven by the belief that doctors provided better care than midwives. However, medical intervention often introduced new dangers. Twilight sleep became popular, drugging women into semi-consciousness, and fathers were excluded from the delivery room.
Some mothers, perhaps you, may want a certain kind of anesthetic. Feel free to ask for it, but by all means leave the decision in your doctor's hands. Try to keep your mind free of worry and hurry. You can rely on your doctor and his helpers, you know. They've brought a lot of babies into the world.
Women
were still having their legs strapped down. They were sometimes having their arms strapped down. I was largely frightened by the idea that so many things could be done against your will because you were having a baby.
This is also when the concept of scientific motherhood took hold. Books like Care and Feeding of Children advise strict schedules, discouraging coddling babies with too much affection. And side note, because I couldn't resist, doctors in the early 1900s told mothers that picking up their crying babies too much would spoil them. Yes, because nothing ruins a child more than love and affection. And meanwhile, these were the same people prescribing heroin for coughs. So maybe let's take their advice with a grain of morphine. Another interesting thing happened in December 1941 in the United States when we entered World War II and the U.S. government soon after launched the Rosie the Riveter propaganda campaign, encouraging women to pitch in with the war effort while the men were off fighting. And they did. During that period, 3 million women joined the workforce, but they were still expected to take care of kids, manage the household, and wear lipstick. And they did it all, without missing a beat. And for over a decade, women held down the country, raised a generation of kids, worked to support the war effort, all while putting dinner on the table.
Harvey, want anything special for your birthday?
Just a decent cup of coffee.
You're kidding.
I'm serious. Honey, your coffee's undrinkable.
Pretty harsh.
Well, so's your coffee. You know, the girls down at the office make better coffee on their hot plates.
You know, if I could just make a decent cup of coffee, I could relax.
By the 1950s, nearly 90% of births took place in hospitals. Routine interventions such as episiotomies and forceps deliveries were common, often without patient consent. And formula feeding was promoted as superior to breastfeeding. And fathers were still rarely present for births. Birth was considered too graphic and undignified for husbands to witness. I kid you not. The suburban nuclear family became the gold standard. Women were encouraged to dedicate themselves entirely to homemaking and childrearing, with strict gender roles reinforced by media and advertising. Mothers were told that their main job was to keep the house spotless, the kids obedient, and their husbands happy, while looking effortlessly beautiful. So basically, Mad Men, but without the cocktails. Actually, scratch that. There were a lot of cocktails, which also brought the rise of Mother's Little Helper, which were prescription tranquilizers like Valium, which reflected the silent struggles that women were facing.
Well, the main demand, of course, is equal rights. Equal rights to have a job, to have respect, to not be viewed as a piece of meat. Equal rights to set forth our own humanity. Equal rights to get into graduate programs, to get into schools, to training programs. We're the bottom third of the employment in terms of pay. We represent, nonetheless, 34% of the workforce, yet we're the first to be laid off and the last to be hired. There aren't frivolous demands at all. We just want what men have had all these years.
The women's movement of the 1960s began challenging the highly medicalized approach to childbirth. Books like Childbirth Without Fear encouraged women to take an active role in their birth experiences. The natural birth movement gained traction, and Lamaze classes were introduced in the U.S., The 1960s saw a rise in more relaxed parenting styles with Dr. Benjamin Spock's Baby and Child Care, advocating a more intuitive, affectionate approach to raising children. The idea that children should be listened to and emotionally nurtured became more accepted.
It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
The 1970s saw an increase in home births, particularly among countercultural movements and feminists rejecting the over-medicalization of labor. And fathers were finally allowed in the delivery room in many hospitals. And breastfeeding started making a comeback as formula's dominance was challenged. With more women entering the workforce, latchkey kids, children left at home after school due to both parents working, became a new phenomenon. Parenting debates emerged. Should mothers work or should they stay home? And the expectation that mothers should do it all began to take root. The era's parenting norm could best be described as completely hands-off.
At that time, there was no problem, really. as they were growing. They could play in the street right in front of the house. In fact, the fathers would even play ball with them. And the school was just down the street, so they could walk. You didn't worry about them. They were outside all the time. And you didn't have to watch them.
Despite the natural birth movement of the previous decades, the 80s and 90s saw a resurgence in high intervention births. C-section rates rose dramatically as doctors began scheduling deliveries for convenience. Epidurals became the norm, and fetal monitoring technology changed how labor was managed in hospitals. And birth plans became an expected part of the process. This is when the supermom ideal took hold. Women were expected to succeed in both career and motherhood. And intensive parenting began to emerge with a growing focus on structured activities, enrichment programs, and helicopter parenting. Meanwhile, the debate over breastfeeding versus formula feeding intensified. As we enter into the 2000s, mothers continued to be expected to be hyper-involved, from baby sign language to curated playdates. The pressure to do it all skyrocketed as more mothers worked outside the home but were still expected to be primary caregivers. And this brings us to today, where nearly 45% of households have a mom who is the primary or sole breadwinner. Add on the weird pressure of gender reveal parties, Pinterest-worthy baby showers and sprinkles, and the politics of motherhood. And this new era of motherhood has brought new levels of anxiety and shame around moms trying to do it all and have it all.
Does anyone else feel like all of this social progression we've gone through as women has made it so hard to be a mum? And don't get me wrong, I absolutely love my job, which is lucky considering we can't afford to live on one income. I love my friends, I love my son, I love living this kind of well-rounded life, but it is so hard.
And they just feel like the only time they have someone not asking for something or hanging on them or crying is when the screen is in front of them. And it comes with so much mom guilt and just so much, you know, stress that you feel like, am I doing too much? Am I doing enough? Like, where, you know, how much can I give of myself?
This is something that I think about way too often, like more, let's just say every day. But like, I don't think as moms we were ever meant to do this alone. Like, how are we supposed to work full time or now work from home with kids, take care of the kids, take care of the house, have dinner, get all of the housework done, have a beautiful home, work out, make time for friends, have time for extracurricular activities, sports for the kids, keeping up with all the schedules.
And now there's kind of like this societal expectation not to lose yourself to motherhood, even though it's the most consuming experience of your entire life. So you need to be a well-rounded person and still go out on wine nights and do fun things and have your own identity outside of your kids. You need to be a good mom, a good employee, a good wife, a good friend, a good sister.
There is not a support, and you can't vent to anyone saying I'm having a hard day, because everybody's gonna say that you're a bad mom, that you're complaining, and that you chose to have this life. How are you supposed to do it?
Like, I am trying to wear all of these hats, but they won't fit on my head because there's so many hats. Anyway, don't know if anyone else feels the same or if it's just me.
We'll be right back. Welcome to the heroine's journey. There's a scene in the Barbie movie where Ruth Handler, the woman who invented the Barbie doll, says arguably the most profound line in the film.
We mothers stand still so our daughters can look back to see how far they've come.
This line nearly knocked the wind out of me when I first heard it. I think it's because it articulated a deep truth, one that's always lived experientially in my bones, but has never been articulated before. And putting aside the emphasis on just daughters, it's a stunning truth. We mothers stand still so our children can see how far they've come. On some level, this is true no matter what your experience or motherhood is. But I can't help but wonder if this is also true on the most macro scale, that collectively we mothers have stood still so that the world could keep moving, keep advancing, keep progressing toward the future and the phenomenal modern marvels that make up the world as we know it. From germ theory and penicillin to the printing press and the light bulb to refrigeration and all the miraculous advancements to come. Have you considered that what the world sees as you standing still is actually the greatest transformative journey you'll ever take? Because make no mistake, motherhood's most defining feature is not sacrifice. Motherhood's most defining feature is power. There's this idea that a mother's influence happens in the background rather than at the center of history, but look at the timeline of what we've collectively done as moms. Mothers are much more warrior-like than we are ladylike. Look, you may not feel like a warrior goddess when you're peeling a half-eaten granola bar off your couch cushions or cutting grapes into force like a Michelin star sous chef, but mothers are objectively the most powerful creatures alive. We carry humans inside us, we survive on 3 hours of sleep and expired goldfish crackers, and we have the reaction time of a ninja when a kid starts gagging across the room. You think James Bond is impressive? He's never caught projectile vomit midair with one hand. They don't tell you this when you're growing up, but motherhood is an epic heroine's journey. Not the kind with swords or battle cries in history class, but the kind that pushes you past every limit you thought you had. You don't get a map. You don't get training. One day you're just in it, holding a tiny screaming creature who somehow expects you to know exactly what to do and what they need. And they keep expecting you to know what to do even when they have kids of their own. It's powerful. As a mom, you do things you never thought possible. You proofread a last-minute school essay at midnight, half asleep with one eye open. You negotiate with a toddler like a hostage negotiator discussing the importance of pants. You pick a turd out of the bathtub, and you just move on with your life. Power. But here's the thing about heroes' journeys. They aren't just about the battles. They're about transformation. Motherhood isn't a list of tasks, a to-do list of thankless work. It's an initiation. It's crawling through the trenches of exhaustion, doubt, and monotony and emerging, maybe covered in someone else's bodily fluids, maybe sleep-deprived beyond recognition, but changed. Think about every great hero's journey. Frodo carrying the ring, trudging through Middle Earth, slowly losing his grip on sanity. Sound familiar, moms of newborns? Katniss Everdeen, constantly hyper-aware of danger, surviving on instinct and sheer willpower. Hello, every mom of a toddler in a public space. Moana, setting out into the unknown with zero experience, just a vague sense that something is calling her forward. Harry Potter, thrown into a world he wasn't prepared for, surrounded by magical creatures who don't listen and make constant messes. Sarah Connor in Terminator, always on high alert, protecting her children from unseen threats, except in our case, it's choking hazards and YouTube algorithms. Odysseus, just trying to get home, battling obstacles at every turn, constantly being sidetracked by the whims of others. Or as moms call it, trying to leave the house. Yes, your version looks different, and that's okay. But if you sung Wheels on the Bus 347 times in one day, if you've debated whether your kid's artwork is beautiful or slightly concerning, then congratulations. You're the hero. Stay the course. You've been initiated. Aristotle once wrote that poets, the storytellers, shape the world. He knew a secret that Walt Disney, Steven Spielberg, Maya Angelou, and Steve Jobs also understood. Those who tell the stories hold the power to shape a generation. But what's often overlooked is that the first stories that shape us are the ones whispered at bedtime. They're the stories that form us and stay with us for a lifetime. These stories, passed from one generation to the next, build the foundation for faith and courage and resilience. As G.K. Chesterton reminds us, fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beaten. The world likes to tell us that motherhood is small, that it's a side story, background noise to the things that actually matter. But if you look at any great hero's journey, any myth, any epic, what do you see? Sacrifice, courage, grit, rising from disappointment, resurrective love, and most of all, the ability to overcome. Power. Sound familiar?
This has been Bloodline and Backbone, a production of Momco Media, created by Mandy Arioto. It was written by Emma Turnbull and Mandy Arioto. Produced by Jeremiah Shoemaker. Music composition and sound design by Sleepy Dog Creative. Our executive producer is Kelly Joe Smith. And our theme song is Glory by Zuri Alvarado. If this episode moved you, share it with someone who needs to hear it, and don't forget to follow the podcast so you never miss a new story. You can reach us at media@themom.co. We'll see you next time on Bloodline and Backbone.